Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. This is the weekly show here on Premier Christian Radio that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, bringing you conversations that matter from all over the world. And it's a delight to be joined on today's show by a US and Australian voice, Luke Barnes and Sean Carroll, my guests on today's programme. Before I get round to introducing them and the topic that we're going to be talking about, let me remind you that Unbelievable is also available, as well as every Saturday, on your radio set via Premier Christian Radio as a podcast too. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Join the many people who download it from week to week as a podcast there. You can find more resources as well, including this year's conference on DVD and MP3 CD, and links to the Unbelievable book, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. It's the story of this show. It's my case for faith as well. And we've got signed copies available from the website where you can get them, unbelievablebook.co.uk. It was great fun to be on the Bad Christian podcast in the last week, talking to a few very down-to-earth guys out in the States who run a really interesting program where they get all kinds of different points of view on. And if you want to listen to that, check them out, Bad Christian Podcast. But the book available also, of course, as an audiobook, Kindle, and all the other options available. Again, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Straight after Unbelievable today, I'm in conversation with Brian McLaren, re-airing an interview I had with him actually before the US elections took place last year. So you'll hear his walk of faith and life and his take on all of that as a leading progressive voice out in the USA. The profile also available as its own podcast as well. Do check that out. If you enjoy Unbelievable, you'll more than likely enjoy many of the episodes that we air of The Profile too. Time to get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Today on Unbelievable, we're asking, what is the best explanation of the universe, God or naturalism? I'm really excited about today's show because two eminent physicists are joining me on the programme. We love doing these kinds of debates on Unbelievable. Luke Barnes joins me in studio. He's an astrophysicist researching at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy. He's a Christian, believes that there are significant elements of our growing knowledge of cosmology that are consistent with a theistic worldview. His recent book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, was co-authored with atheist physicist Geraint Lewis. And both authors agree on the so-called fine tuning of the universe, but differ on whether it offers evidence for a creator. If you want to find out more about Luke, lukebarnes.info and the book there. Sean Carroll is our other guest, joining us on the line from the States. He's a well-known cosmologist and research professor of physics at Caltech in the USA. Sean is an atheist. His most recent book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning and the universe itself, sets out why he believes naturalism best explains the nature of the universe we inhabit, as extraordinary and mysterious as it is. And, well, rather suitably, he's got a similarly titled website to A Fortunate Universe. His is preposterousuniverse.com if you want to find out more about Sean and his regular blogs there. And so today we're going to be examining why both these brilliant cosmologists come to such different conclusions about whether there could be a divine origin for the universe. We'll be talking about poetic naturalism. We'll be looking at whether there is a divine cause for the universe, whether fine-tuning of the universe proposes evidence for design, and so on. All important issues, ones we've done before in various ways on Unbelievable, but always so interesting to get new guests and new takes on these issues. So, Sean and Luke, welcome along to the programme.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks.
It's great to have you both. Let's start with you, Luke, as you've flown all the way from Australia to be on the programme today. Not really. You've got other things to do, I think, with your time while you're here. But you're over here on just a little sort of speaking tour with your co-author, I believe, Geraint.
Yes, we'll be around the place. We'll be speaking in various places around the country and telling people sort of both sides of what this whole fine-tuning thing's about.
And tell us about your own background. You're a Christian, but you're a physicist. You're someone who sort of spends your time looking into the workings of the universe. To what extent would you say the two kind of cooperate with each other on in terms of the, you know, your study in the area and what it, whether it does or doesn't sort of tie in with your belief in God?
Well, most of the everyday work of the physicist, I think, it looks the same, whatever your views are. So I write papers with Geraint, and he's an atheist. And It's basically we're trying to work out how the universe works. And for Geraint, it's working out what the ultimate principles of the universe are. And for me, it's working out how God made the universe. But we're asking the same sorts of questions.
Absolutely. And with this latest book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, it's interesting that you've co-authored this. So I guess that was intentionally with the idea of an atheist and a Christian both looking at the same evidence, obviously agreeing in large degree on the phenomenon of fine-tuning, and we'll come to define that a bit later, but with different parting ways when it comes to whether God or something else is a valid explanation.
Yeah, I'd say there are a range of views, but Geraint and I, for the most part, agree on the basic story about what would happen if certain properties of our universe were different, if this particle were heavier or that sort of thing. So the most of the book is just us trying to explain what would happen, and then the last chapter is just what do we think all this means.
Great. And do you find that there's a sort of significant conversation going on in the sciences around the kind of metaphysical implications, I suppose, of cosmology and fine-tuning and that kind of thing? Because obviously I live and breathe the world of sort of Christian apologetics and theology, so maybe I have a, you know, see it more than it actually is. I don't know whether generally physicists are talking about the way these things connect with questions about ultimate causes and so on.
If they do, it's usually in the pub, I find. So there is a sort of scientific question of fine tuning about why do these numbers have the value that they do. And there's, you know, I was at a conference a couple of months ago which brought together scientists and philosophers to talk about that sort of thing, and so that conversation's happening, and you know, in the pub afterwards, there's a lot of talk about what it means.
Okay. So I'd love to be part of the conversation. I'm sure it would all mostly go over my head. But in any case, it's great to have you in the UK for a little while and able to come into the Unbelievable studio and talk about this stuff, Luke. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Sean Carroll is also on the line from the US, well-known cosmologist, research professor of physics at Caltech in the USA. Sean, have you sort of basically been involved in science since as long as you can remember, would you say?
Science, yeah, I probably got interested in back when I was around 10 years old, reading books in the library, hearing about the Big Bang and black holes and quarks and leptons, and I thought, you know, I want to do that for a living, whatever it is. And so far, so good. I've not grown past the ambitions of my 10-year-old self.
Great ambition to have from 10 years old. What about your atheism, though? I think, are you happy to wear that label, firstly? And is that something that has always been there or something that you adopted at a later stage in life?
I mean, I'm happy to wear it if someone says that I'm atheist. I don't disagree with them because it's true. It's not the first self-description that I choose just because the obvious reason that it's just saying something I don't believe is true rather than something I do believe is true. But I wasn't born an atheist. I guess I was born an atheist. When I literally was born, I didn't have many beliefs about the bigger picture questions. But I grew up in a fairly mildly religious, suburban white American family, going to an Episcopalian church, etc. And it was gradually through my junior high school, college years that I became more clear about what I believed, and that was an atheist point of view.
And you've never seen any reason to adopt any other kind of worldview than that?
No, not at all.
Okay. Obviously, you've very much been involved in some of the, you know, fairly high profile discussions at this level. I mean, again, I suppose I'd ask the same question as I did of Luke. Do you think this is a going concern generally, you know, in the physics and in the community as to whether there are theistic or implications to the kinds of things that science is telling us about the universe?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. And there's sort of two different levels to it. One is when physicists or scientists more generally come together to understand how the world works at the most fundamental level. How much of a role does God or something beyond the physical world actually play? And there, the answer is, you know, almost zero. There's the occasional person, Don Page is a good friend of mine, who is one example, who likes to throw God into his occasional cosmology seminars. But at the 99.9% level, whether you're doing molecular biology or chemistry or astrophysics, God has nothing to do with anything. I actually think that's very telling. I think 500 years ago would have been a very different story. But modern science not only doesn't need to rely on explanations that are based on God, but doesn't even contemplate that would be a thing to do. The other level is, of course, the more the public sphere or the broader conversation, where, of course, a lot of people are religious. A lot of people have some either clearly or vaguely defined sense of something beyond the physical world. And there, I think it's kind of a shame that there's not more conversation between scientists and other people, whatever their beliefs might be. You know, I have my point of view, Luke has his point of view, but the important thing is that we're both out there acknowledging that these things have something to do with each other. Mm. And I get very sad or puzzled by people who want to pretend that these things are completely independent, like that we can talk about how the world is and then talk about the existence of God as if those two things are somehow not connected.
Well, great introduction to sort of the way you approach these things. And we're going to be getting into the big picture that you set out in your most recent book called The Big Picture. We're going to be talking about poetic naturalism. We're going to be talking about fine tuning. We're going to be talking about Big Bang cosmology in the course of today's program. As we ask, what is the best explanation for the universe, God or naturalism? I'm sure there's going to be lots of people responding to today's show. If you'd like to be one of them, then why not email me your thoughts about today's program? That's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online, of course, at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Leave comments underneath today's show, share it on, find the podcast, and indeed comment via the Facebook and Twitter accounts as well. All the social media links available from the webpage. Again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking today about the universe. Luke Barnes and Sean Carroll join me to talk about this. And perhaps I'll come back to you first of all, Sean, to tell us about a concept that you talk about in your book to some extent, poetic naturalism. You say you're happy to wear the label atheist if someone gives it to you, but I suppose more specifically you subscribe to naturalism. But you've also added this other dimension to it, poetic naturalism. Can you briefly explain what that is and how that gives you a sort of a picture, a framework for understanding the universe?
Sure. Although I honestly think it's the naturalism part that is more relevant to our discussion today than the poetic part. Mm. But modern philosophers, to make things easy for themselves, distinguish between two big camps within the world of ontology, you know, what exists, what the fundamental nature of being is, theism and naturalism. So any kind of religious belief or spiritual belief would generally be theistic. Naturalism says that there is only one world, the natural world, the world that, you know, we experience somehow, whether or not we see it directly is a complicated question of quantum mechanics and so forth. But the physical world would be, you know, the most obvious instantiation of this natural world. And it's the world that we learn about by scientific investigation. We don't have a priori access to it. We don't have revelatory access to it. We invent hypotheses and then we go test them by going to look at what the world actually is. The poetic part comes about because, of course, just like religion, although not nearly as advanced, naturalists disagree with each other about different points of doctrine. So there are extremely austere naturalists who want to say that anything other than the most fundamental description of reality is an illusion. So consciousness is an illusion, free will is an illusion, but also tables and chairs and people and planets are illusions, because really the only thing that exists is some quantum wave function at the very deepest level. Mm. I think that's far too impoverished. We should be able to help ourselves to these higher level concepts just as much as these lower level concepts. But then there's also, on the other hand, there are naturalists who sort of can't quite resist the temptation to add things to their naturalism, whether it is in addition to physical states of matter, there could be mental states of matter. So it would be naturalist, but not completely physicalist. Mm. That is a category that exists. For example, David Chalmers, a famous philosopher of consciousness, falls into that camp. Or many other naturalists want to believe in some objective moral truths that exist outside the physical world. I don't believe in those things either. I think that those are ways of talking about the physical world. And that's where the poetic comes in, that there are choices in how we talk about the physical world. It's one world, but there are many ways of talking about it. That would be the motto that you would put under poetic naturalism.
That's really helpful, succinct definition there. And in a sense, helps, I suppose, to frame what you're going to be defending, I suppose, in regards to what science tells us about the world, that we are, that it supports a naturalistic hypothesis. And that, yeah, I guess what I hear from you is that it's the utility of some of these higher level things, free will, consciousness, etc., that we kind of use because we need to use them, I suppose, in some ways, are the extra elements we add in there. But Luke, let's come to you, because you're a Christian, you're a theist, so I suppose that defines your worldview. I mean, do you want to add anything to that? Do you want to sort of flesh that out in any further way?
Well, I assume that most of your listeners know what Christianity is, so I'm quite happy to just leave it that there is a, you know, as well as the physical world, there is a creator of the physical world. The fundamental principles of natural stuff aren't the fundamental principles of reality. There is a level deeper than that, in the form of a good creator. I think that's.
And from your point of view, what's your understanding of what Sean has just described to us in terms of naturalism, or specifically poetic naturalism? Is that a is that what you believe a lot of the atheists you speak to are kind of subscribed to at some level, or do some of them not want to defend a particular worldview at all, such as naturalism?
So I think that's actually quite clear. One of the things I appreciated about Sean's book was actually the laying down that he really does believe something. He really does have some stuff to explain about the universe, and not just the universe, but things like, you know, life and values and free will and all those sorts of things. So I find some atheists sort of think that they just believe in science and that's it, whereas actually, you know, as Sean was saying, there's a bit more to it than that. There's things you need to explain. So I sort of appreciate that viewpoint.
Okay. I mean, there are, I guess, atheists, as you say, who sort of equate science with reality, in a sense that all we need is science to in order to. But are you saying that Sean goes a bit beyond simply saying, you know, science works, that's all we need, that there's sort of some metaphysical assumptions about, you know, the way the world is that he's essentially defending, as well as sort of being a scientific person in the process?
Yeah, I mean, I can let Sean speak to himself here, but one of the things I quite appreciated about the book was simply that Sean is talking about ontology and the things that we can do with science, and it's not just that you know, we just look at the world and that's all there is to it. We have to think philosophically about these things.
Yeah, I guess, Sean, in that level, you maybe part company slightly with some of your peers who might say, you know, my position is simply the natural position, if you like. I don't need to defend atheism or naturalism or whatever, because it's sort of the de facto position. Whereas you're more keen on actually saying, no, we have something to present here, a kind of a worldview to actually defend at some level.
I think that there's two separate issues here that I don't want to get completely mixed up together. One is the idea that we can say that there exists the physical world obeying the laws of physics, and that we are then done saying things. That's sort of an ontological claim, and that is one that I disagree with. I think that there, as Luke says, there's more to talk about in terms of purpose and meaning and values and so forth, and we can have sensible, intelligent, cogent conversations about those things as naturalists, but they're not obvious conversations. We have to think about them and really work things out. So that is one way that some naturalists disagree with other naturalists. There's a very different issue about what needs defending. I think that I don't even know that many naturalists who think that their viewpoint doesn't need defending. And I think that one of the sort of frustrating ways that many people who disagreed with my book commented on it was that they took things that I thought I had presented a point of view and then argued for it and presented evidence for it, and they seemed to think that they were assumptions that I was making rather than things that I was concluding. I certainly don't think that naturalism is a priori, or just, you know, something that doesn't need defending. It's one of the hypotheses on the table, like many, many others are. I think we come to naturalism by reasoning and collecting evidence. We do not start with it as an assumption.
Do you have a problem with the idea of you know, that as naturalism, as an explanation of, you know, something we arrive at through a process of reasoning and looking at the world around us, Luke?
Well, that's a perfectly intelligible claim, and it's one that Sean, he's absolutely right. He sets that out in the book. He makes an argument. There's no unexamined assumptions there. He's right in the thick of it. So I agree with all of that. I disagree with the conclusion, of course. But there are There's no assumption of naturalism in the book. It's something he argues to. There's no assumption that science will just answer all our questions. There's nothing else left to do. That there is the sort of philosophical arguments there.
I'm guessing from the way you're speaking, though, what you're finding Sean's approach quite refreshing here, because I assume you've heard too many times science is naturalism or something, that the two are perfectly equated in some way, that if you're committed to the scientific method, you're committed to naturalism by default or something.
Yeah, I have heard that view that we don't. It comes up actually from a lot of scientists who are atheists who then decide that they need to attack philosophy, which is not something that Sean does. But you do see that view, and they will simply attack philosophy as if there's nothing else to do. We'll just keep doing science, and that's
it. Are you willing to name a name of it?
There were attacks against philosophers by Lawrence Krauss and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and even Stephen Hawking, someone as eminent as him, just saying that philosophy is dead and philosophy can mess you up and philosophers are moronic and these sorts of things. But that's not the Sean is much more careful and sophisticated than that.
Do you think people who do kind of dismiss philosophy and say all we need is science are making a mistake yourself, Sean?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I think that it's kind of a hilarious mistake in the sense that none of these people, and a lot of them are just speaking casually, right? I mean, they're sort of joking around. Like when Stephen Hawking says philosophy is dead, Stephen Hawking knows perfectly well that that's going to sell books. He likes riling people up a little bit, okay? And literally two sentences later, he's making philosophical claims just as much as any other philosopher. Mm-hmm. And I think that he kind of knows that and he's being a little naughty. And I wish he wouldn't do that, but it's not completely as unsophisticated as it comes off. I do think that there's a closely related issue here that gets mixed up in people's minds, which is maybe worth teasing out, which is there's this idea called methodological naturalism, which is usually defined as the idea that when science tackles a question, science is only allowed to suggest naturalistic explanations. That the way that science moves forward is by assuming that naturalism is true, whether or not it is true, but what science does is look for the natural explanations. Now, I think, number one, this is false. That's not actually what science does. I think that science looks for the true explanations. And number two, I think that this is an attempt to do something politically savvy, especially here in the United States, but failing even on that score. This idea of methodological naturalism, as much as anything else, grew out of the idea that we shouldn't be teaching creationism in schools. So it was an attempt to define what you teach in science class to preclude supernatural explanations from the start. So I think that it was sort of bad politics and bad philosophy at the same time.
What's your thought on the methodological naturalism, Luke?
I think I agree with Sean that not a lot of clarity has come out of the discussion between evolution and creationism in Australia or America or the UK, but I don't subscribe to methodological naturalism from my worldview. There are natural things, and if we watch natural things closely enough, we'll see the laws that they obey, and that is simply the scientific method. It's not that I think all explanations will be scientific ones, but what I'm trying to discover about the world is how natural stuff works. I want to know how electrons work, and so I watch electrons.
Yeah. Look, we're going to go to our first break a little early, but the good news is we're going to give the whole of today's program over to this discussion, because when you get Luke Barnes and Sean Carroll on the same program, you might as well give all your time to it. So I'm really looking forward to today's discussion. We've sort of laid the ground a bit with the world views that each here is defending in terms of naturalism and a theistic explanation for the universe. And we're going to be talking about, some of the cosmology that has been used by some theologians to suggest that there is a divine cause of the universe, and there's a philosophy that goes alongside that. The fine-tuning of the universe as well is something we'll be doing. And can I encourage you, if you haven't read either of them, to get hold of Luke's book, A Fortunate Universe, and of course The Big Picture by Sean Carroll as well. They're my two guests on the program today. One's an atheist, one's a Christian, and we're asking, what is the best explanation of the universe, God or naturalism? And we'll be back in just a moment's time.
Welcome to the program that brings Christians and non-Christians together with me, Justin Brierley.
For over 10 years, as host of Unbelievable, I've listened to objections to faith from the world's leading skeptics. And the most common question I get is, how come you still believe? Unbelievable, the book, is my answer. Telling the story of the show and drawing on hundreds of conversations with atheists and Christians, I explain why I still believe Jesus is the answer to life's deepest questions. Get your copy of Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, at unbelievablebook.co.uk.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. Really excited to be joined by Luke Barnes and Sean Carroll on today's show, asking what's the best explanation of the universe, God or naturalism? And if you're interested in Unbelievable, the kinds of issues and debates that, like today, that we're having, then you'll be interested in our back catalogue available from the website. Lots of people download the podcast every week. You can join them. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to some of the various other bits and pieces that are available from the Unbelievable stable, including our conference on DVD from earlier in the year, and Unbelievable, the book, where I explain why I'm still a Christian after 10 or more years of talking with atheists on this programme. But there's also ways to get in touch as well, and I do encourage you to send in your thoughts. I'll make sure to read out the ways to get in touch a little later on in the programme. Straight after Unbelievable, you can hear The Profile, another Christian talking about their walk of faith and life. That's all part of Faith Explored this Saturday afternoon. Unbelievable, of course, though, is the place where we get people of different perspectives talking to each other. Luke Barnes, astrophysicist and researcher at the Sydney Institute for Astronomy, joins me here in studio. He's a Christian. He believes that there are significant elements of our growing knowledge of cosmology to suggest that the universe was created, was purposed, was, you know, has a cause beyond itself, if you like. And that's the topic really that gets debated in his most recent book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Fine-Tuned Cosmos, co-authored with atheist physicist Geraint Lewis. Sean Carroll, a well-known cosmologist and research professor of physics at Caltech in the USA, joins me too. He's an atheist. His most recent book, The Big Picture, on the origins of life, meaning, and the universe itself, sets out why he believes naturalism best explains the nature of the universe. And again, links to both of them and where you can find out more from today's programme. Luke, let's come to you because I think the advent of what's often called Big Bang cosmology sort of lent a new impetus to this as you know, the research from the 20s onwards started to point to a universe which appeared to have this extraordinary quality of having, in a sense, if you wound the clock back, you would find it becoming hotter and denser to a, you know, what many people determine a singularity, a boundary to space and time. Well, some people, you know, go as far as to call a beginning, if you like. And that, in a sense, got a lot of people excited about the possible, you know, is this the equivalent of creation ex nihilo and so on? Could God be the explanation for this? I mean, I don't want to put words into your mouth, though. So where do you approach this as a physicist, as in someone who obviously does believe in the possibility, Luke, of a divine creator ultimately behind the universe?
So I think there are some very interesting clues, and they're at that level. It's kind of interesting that over the last, say, 80, 90 years of cosmology, that some cosmologists who were trying to understand how the universe worked looked very hard at their models and found that in those models there was something that looked an awful lot like a cosmic beginning, a point you couldn't extrapolate back past in time. Now, there's been an awful lot of back and forth in science then. People have, you know, tried to take that out of the beginning, put it back in the beginning. There's all sorts of things coming into play there. What really interests me as a cosmologist is there's a great big question mark at the beginning of the universe where we're not quite sure what's going on, but there's a lot of things that point to a beginning. But if you're a naturalist, if there was a beginning in the universe, you just have to say that the universe just came into existence and that's all there is to it as a brute fact, if there was a beginning. And I think that's something that worries me a lot about naturalism.
So before we come back to Sean on this, are you essentially saying that your theistic outlook, as it were, is more consistent, sort of carries better with the evidence from science on this front than, as far as you can see, a naturalistic, brute factish kind of ness of the universe does?
What I'd say is if it turns out that our best cosmological ideas make it more likely than not that the universe has a beginning, that's something that I could personally, it wouldn't keep me up at night, in the same way that the entire universe popping into existence out of nothing might keep a naturalist up at night. It's another question whether we have those clues. I think we do, but Sean will have his view on that, and there's every cosmologist will have their views on that.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to be simply grazing the surface of what is a huge area here, Sean. But do you want to sort of briefly spell out why, in your view, we don't have to jump to any kind of supernatural conclusions, even though, you know, a lot of what the cosmology tells us looks something like a beginning to the universe?
Yeah, well, as you indicate, there are lots of issues to talk about here. Let me just see if I can remember everything that popped into my mind over the last 10 minutes. Number one, no, I don't think that I'm especially bothered by the existence of brute facts in a physicalist or naturalist account of a universe with a beginning. I think that theistic accounts also have brute facts. And I know that most theists disagree with that because they try to argue that something like God is a necessary part of the universe, not just a brute fact that could have been there or not. And that's an actual intellectual disagreement. I do not think that God or anything else counts as a necessary part of the world. Number two, there's this very, very difficult time we have in talking about the idea that the universe had a beginning. It is almost impossible to resist using locutions like Luke just used about the universe popping into existence. Mm. But I really, really want to try to avoid using those kinds of phrases because it gives the impression that there was something called nothingness, and then there was this temporal process by which the universe came into existence, which, you know, no one really thinks that that's true. So there's no sense in which the universe pops into existence, even if it has a beginning. I like to just stick to saying the universe has a beginning in these models. It may or may not be the correct cosmological model, but a universe with a first moment of time or a beginning. And finally, I think that as a naturalist, the thing to do is to say, you know, given the evidence that we have of how the laws of physics work, given what we do know about the universe, which is certainly not enough to definitively say what happened at the beginning, does it seem plausible that the universe had a beginning? Does it seem plausible that time had a first moment? And right now, it's plausible. We have perfectly sensible-looking frameworks in which that would be the case, but we're very far from saying that it actually is the case. It's equally plausible that the universe has lasted forever.
Do you agree that that's just as plausible a way of seeing the universe, that it's eternal in some way, Luke?
So I do think it is plausible, like Sean says, but there is a great big question mark, as I said. The thing that really bothers me about this, and Sean's right about the popping into existence, like it's very hard to talk about cosmology at all, to be honest. You've really got to work hard. But certainly talking about a beginning is very difficult. What really bothers me is if the best scientific conclusion we had was that the universe had a beginning, then what the naturalist would have to say is that the whole of reality as it actually exists, right, and if this is true in the model of reality, simply had a beginning, and there's no reason why it came into existence, and there's nothing else to say about what exists other than the universe, that there would just be a brute fact that for no reason the whole of physical reality had a beginning point, however you want to say it. I'll try not to say popped in. Yeah, you can all say that in your own head at home. That's what bothers me. If naturalism was true, I'd have to say something like that, just sort of stare down the entire existence of the universe without, and try not to think that, hang on, there must be some reason why the universe exists.
Mm. I mean, what you're describing there almost goes back to, you know, before the kind of cosmological theories that we're familiar with today, where philosophers like Leibniz are talking about, you know, the idea that, you know, why is there something rather than nothing, you know, and his, in a sense, cosmological argument was, you know, that delved into this idea that given that the universe appears to have every, in every sense, is a contingent thing, didn't have to exist, that it must have a cause in something that is not contingent, i.e. necessary, and that's where this idea of God as a necessary being. Now, it looked like you wanted to come back on, you know, what Sean had to say there about, you know, he doesn't buy this idea of God as being the one necessary thing. And obviously, Sean specifically spoke of God as part of the universe or whatever. This is where obviously the physics starts to cross over into the philosophy and the metaphysics and so on. But for you, is this kind of, you know, a natural kind of conclusion for you that you have to go beyond the kind of brute fact of the existence of a physical realm to that it seems like there needs to be something that is a cause of that particular realm?
Well, maybe I could put it this way. I think a good principle to go with it would be, if you can explain something, then do explain it as just an epistemic starting point rather than something deeper or ontological or that. So what I see from A Necessary Being is there's a chance here to explain why anything at all exists. And if we can make sense of that explanation, even if it's not completely understood, right? I'm not going to say I totally understand what philosophers are talking about when they talk about necessary beings. But if I can see value to that explanation, then there's an awfully large fact about reality, the fact that it exists, which we could understand in some way. And if you can explain something, then do.
Okay. Sean, how do you want to respond to this? Because obviously, for you, the fact that Luke says you're kind of just satisfying yourself with the brute fact of the existence of physical reality. And you say, well, Christians are just as much lumped with the brute facts themselves. And when it comes to God, you're just not convinced that you need to have an explanation beyond what we can physically observe in terms of the universe.
I'm more or less completely convinced that we are always going to bottom out our series of explanations, that they will end somewhere. In fact, I think that what is called for here is a more nuanced idea of what an explanation is. And I think that, you know, as Luke said, there is this temptation, there's this feeling like, you know, there must be explanations for things. And I think that in the context of modern science, modern physics, that's not the right way to think. I think that we need to think about what you mean by an explanation. There's different kinds of explanations. When we get into things like the causes of things and so forth, there's a very, very different picture we have in modern physics than sort of the folk understanding of explaining why your car died. Well, it's because it ran out of gas, right? And I think that it's a different way of thinking about things at the deepest level that has been very, very successful to modern science. And in some sense, it's a much more straightforward, simple demand. It's find the laws of physics, find the patterns that nature seems to obey, and ask what things could happen that are consistent with those patterns and what things would not happen that are not consistent with those patterns. The language of causes and explanations is inappropriate when we're talking about the fundamental nature of reality. So from that perspective, there's zero bother or worry in my mind that the universe can exist. Things are going to exist. The question is, do things obey the laws of nature?
And this is often the issue that's brought up when, for instance, you know, a popular sort of argument in apologetics is the Kalam cosmological argument, which you've obviously debated with William Lane Craig, where I guess your view is you simply can't speak of a cause of the universe when you get to that kind of quantum level of reality where, because you can't talk of causes when you're going beyond the boundary of time and so on, that these concepts break down. Is that kind of where you're going with this, Sean, as I understand it?
Yeah, I mean, just a very tiny little gloss on that would be that you don't have to talk about causes in that context. There's always the very, very real possibility that we don't understand everything about the universe. Maybe what we see is the universe is part of some much larger framework, whether it's a multiverse or something even beyond that. And within that framework, one can talk about causes. But if the universe is the whole of physical reality, then talking about causes, looking for causes, would be inappropriate. And I think that it is exactly parallel to the idea of, you know, could the universe have had a first moment of time? When I was debating William Lane Craig, he was incredulous that I could imagine both that the universe had a first moment and that it was uncaused. And his argument was basically like, if universes can just pop into existence, then why don't bicycles pop into existence? And the point is, well, we have perfectly good explanations for that. Bicycles popping into existence would violate the laws of physics. It would violate laws of conservation of energy and momentum and things like that. The question to ask is, would a universe having a first moment of time violate the laws of physics? To the best of our current understanding, the answer is no.
Is that your best understanding, Luke? And why would you differ from what Sean has to say there.
Well, yeah, let me just jump in on that. So it's very interesting. So the reason why bicycles don't jump into don't pop into existence, there's that phrase again, is because it would violate the laws of physics. No, but Sean, am I right? You think the laws of physics are just ways of talking about the events in the universe. There's just the stuff that happens. They're called the Humean there's the Humean perspective. There's the set of events of stuff that happens. And then we find a useful way of summarizing those, and that's the laws of physics. Is that basically your view of the laws of physics?
Yeah, that's pretty close. That's fine.
Right. So in that case, the laws of physics don't do any. Well, I mean, what do you mean violate the laws of physics? It's not like the laws of physics. You don't have a governance view, right? It's not the case that there are the laws of physics really are something that do things like you know, that matter has certain properties, certain causal properties, and in the interactions with those, that's what makes the laws of physics hold in our universe. You don't believe in fundamental causal properties, and so the laws of nature have no power there. Or there are just why aren't we in a universe in which it is the case that bicycles do just pop into existence? It's not because of the laws. All what would happen in that universe is you would have to say something like, the best summary of the universe I have is, here's the equations of quantum field theory. Oh, by the way, on the 10th of October, a bicycle's going to pop into existence in London. That would be your laws of nature.
Yeah, that's right, and that's completely plausible if that were what the evidence demanded. Happily, we have a much simpler theory, which is here are the laws of nature, and that's it. And I think that's what our burden is as scientists, to find the best possible theory that explains what we see in nature. So I don't feel any need to grant the laws of nature any coercive properties. They're a description of what happens. So the question about the origin of the universe or the beginning is compatible with the simplest descriptions of what we actually do see. Is it also possible the universe just had a beginning? If the answer were, you know, if there were a different answer, if there was sort of the laws of physics that we noticed by doing our experiments and our observations here on Earth, and that was somehow incompatible with the idea or some notion we really wanted to hold true about the beginning of the universe, then I would count that as evidence against that particular view of how nature behaved. My point is just that we have no evidence against that. The evidence that we have is all completely compatible with the idea that there are patterns in how nature behaves here around us, and those patterns are consistent with the universe having a beginning.
Right, but remember the question. The question was, why aren't there more, if there are brute facts, like the existence of the universe, why aren't there more brute facts? That was the question. And the question was, what, for example, why don't bicycles appear in this room right now? And it sounded like the answer you gave ultimately was, well, thankfully, in our universe, that doesn't happen. But that's not an explanation. If brute facts are allowed, why aren't there more of them? And if the real problem is, if you allow brute facts, they don't have reasons. And so there can't be a reason why there aren't more brute facts or less brute facts or only universes are brute facts rather than bicycles being brute facts. So the objection here is that once you've opened the door to brute facts, you can't then stop the whole party piling in. It's a clown car. Everything's going to come flying out. Why aren't there more brute facts? The fact that there aren't more brute facts, the fact that there is a simple way of describing the universe in which there's no bicycles that pop into existence, is the thing to be explained.
Yeah, but it may not have an explanation. I don't think we have the right to demand an explanation for that. I think that the fact that there are very few brute facts is a brute fact. But I don't think that brute facts are things we open a door to. I think that you absolutely can't avoid them. It is a happy fact of the universe that we seem to live in that there's a very simple set of rules that it seems to obey. If you just want to say, well, why is it that way? I'm just going to say that's how it is. And there's no hope of, once we understand the ultimate laws of physics, asking for more than that.
Okay, can I just jump in quickly? You said we don't have a right to demand an explanation. When do we have the right to demand an explanation?
Well, in the context of some bigger picture, right? So we say we explain why bicycles don't pop into existence because there's something called conservation of energy momentum. And then you say, well, why is there conservation of energy momentum? Well, because the laws of physics have this property that there are certain symmetries. Why do they have that property? Well, I don't know. That's just it. That's the bottom, right? I think that there's absolutely no way out of hitting a bottom at these of these chains of explanation.
Whereas you, Luke, appear to be open to the idea that we haven't hit rock bottom when we get to the fundamental laws of physics, of reality. You think that it's perfectly feasible to say we don't have to assume a brute fact here about reality. We can say this could have an explanation beyond itself in God, in something that is necessary in that sense of, I guess you digress from the way Sean sees it, that God's just another brute fact. You don't see God having quite the same kind of explanation. It's a different kind of explanation, presumably, to just that there is a universe in that sense.
Right. So here's a way I like to explain it. Suppose that physicists, we totally nail this universe, right? We solve the crossword puzzle. It's all done. We're staring at a blackboard in which the ultimate principles of reality are in fact written. Now, how we'd know that is another question entirely. But suppose, you know, Albert Einstein's great, 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 great granddaughter, Alberta, has written them on the board for us and we're all just staring at them. The question is whether, I mean, certainly first implication is we all high five, because that would be a phenomenal achievement. But the question then is whether we would be okay with just saying that's the ultimate principles of reality. If you have any more questions that try to go deeper than the blackboard, just swallow them and like, we've reached the end, that's all. Or is there questions raised by the blackboard which you would still want answers to, like, why is there a universe which is described by the stuff on this blackboard? Why is there, you know, stuff at all? Why does it obey scientific laws at all? Why is it, you know, particularly, presumably, rather elegant, beautiful mathematical principles? So what Sean is saying, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, is we'd get to the end, we'd look at that blackboard and we go, high five, we're all done. If you've got any further questions, well, we've bottomed out, so just deal with it. Whereas I think, you know, if you can explain something, do. If there's a level of explanation which can help us understand why that blackboard and why all those other questions, we should go for it.
I mean, can I just jump in with a question maybe for you, Sean, which is one of those examples which I find fascinating, but I don't think gets talked about often enough, actually, is the elegance of the physical sort of geometry of the universe, the mathematics that, you know, Eugene Wigner described as the, you know, the extraordinary effectiveness of mathematics and so on. Which I have heard, you know, theologians and philosophers, you know, theistic philosophers use again as a sort of consistency with a theistic worldview, that we would expect to find that kind of a beautiful symmetry of equations and so on. On a naturalistic view, it's just a brute fact. It's just a kind of extraordinarily lucky coincidence that we happen to live in a universe that's so eminently discoverable and, you know, that we can plot on with a pen and paper and so on. And where do you land on that? Do you just sort of have to say it just is the way it is and we're very fortunate? Do you see that there's a legitimacy in, I guess, what Luke is saying, which is, no, that's begging and that's crying out for an explanation beyond itself?
No, actually, I do think it's legitimate. I mean, I get it. I certainly think that if there were explanations for some of the brute facts that we might have thought were just brute, then that would be better than not having explanations. The more simple you can bring things down to, the better off you are. The important points I'm making are, number one, I don't think anyone is avoiding the existence of brute facts, like it or not. And number two, which we haven't gotten to yet, I think that the actual use of God or theism as the grounding of the brute facts of the universe we observe does a very bad job. I don't think the universe that we observe is in fact what would be predicted by that hypothesis. Like I said before, this is not a priori. I absolutely think it's worthy to contemplate this possibility. I just don't think the evidence is on its side.
Take us down that road then, why you believe that if someone wants to posit God as an explanation, it actually doesn't help their case. We're not in the kind of universe you would expect if there was a God behind the whole show.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually the key point here that should be more focused on by people on both sides of this debate. I think that you're faced with these two competing ontologies, theism and naturalism, And your burden, if you want to decide which one is true, is to be very, very honest with yourself about what you would expect the universe to look like under each theory. And that's very hard to do because we know what the universe looks like to some extent, right? And if you favor one theory over the other, then inevitably you're going to say, yep, that's exactly what the universe should look like under my theory. So personally, and at some level, there's a problem just because on the theistic side, well, even on the, to be fair, even on the naturalistic side, predicting what the universe should be like is not at all straightforward. If you have a specific naturalistic model with actual individual laws of physics, then you can predict things. But just saying naturalism doesn't tell you much about what those individual laws could be. So you can imagine many, many different possibilities. And I think that in the case of theism, it's even worse, because the kind of things that you get as a specific theistic model are far less constrained and rigorous and clear than they are in a specific naturalistic model. You may have noticed that there are theists in the world who disagree with each other about the nature of God, what God wants us to do, etc. And I think that if I try my best to be honest about what I'd expect the universe to look like if God existed and had made it, then there's basically two choices. Either we human beings are important to God or we're not. If we were important, if we human beings had played some crucial role in the nature of the universe, to be frank about it, I expect the universe to be a lot smaller. We don't need a universe anywhere near the enormity and immensity that we see to explain us. We'll at some point get into fine-tuning. I know that Luke is an expert on that, and I think that in some senses, the universe is way more fine-tuned than we would ever expect it to be just for human beings to exist. And to me, that's evidence that it's a physical mechanism that is explaining the fine-tuning, not a theistic explanation. So I think that, you know, if we're trying to be honest about what we would predict, number one, it's very hard, and I'm very sympathetic to people who disagree about it. But number two, I just don't see why we would live in this kind of universe if God had made it for us.
We'll come back to these questions after a short break, and we're going to do another whole segment where we're going to get into these issues. And I think this is a good point at which to transition as well into talking about the fine-tuning of the universe as well in the final segment of today's programme. Fascinating discussion today. Really enjoying this. I hope you're managing to keep up at home if this stuff is new to you or there's any terminology that you need to go over again. Don't forget, you can download the programme. You can go back and listen again and pick it up again. All available from premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Do get in touch with your thoughts about today's programme as well. You can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk, at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, if you want to leave your thoughts that way, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page of the programme. All those links and more, and of course, links to my guests, Luke Barnes and Sean Carroll, from today's show as well. That's at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll be back with the third part of today's discussion here on Unbelievable in just a moment's time. Whatever happened to the promised revival? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, New Frontiers leader Terry Virgo asks whether it's time to reignite revival hopes as he looks at moves of God, past, present, and future. Plus, from Justin Welby to the HDB effect, we examine how evangelicals took over the Church of England. Find out why adoption turned Krish Kandaya's life and theology upside down, and meet Christina Dean, pioneering fashion designer who scours rubbish tips to create ethical clothing. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of today's programme. Unbelievable brings you interesting conversations between all kinds of different perspectives every week. If you're listening, by the way, to the radio edition of today's show, you're getting a slightly truncated version of the conversation between my guests, Sean Carroll and Luke Barnes. If you want to hear it in its full unexpurgated glory, because we went a bit long on recording this one, then do go to the podcast and check that out as well. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can leave comments there, of course, underneath the latest edition of the show. You can find links to where you can leave your thoughts as well on social media, at UnbelievableJB for our Twitter handle, facebook.com slash UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook, and I regularly post interesting articles and bits and pieces there. Because we're going long on today's interview between my two guests, there won't be any chance for feedback, but I do encourage you to send in your thoughts about today's show nonetheless. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and we'll squeeze in as much of that on next week's programme as we can. Next week on the programme, continuing in the scientific mould, Mike McCarg, also known as Science Mike and author of Finding God in the Waves, joins me again. He came in last year for a discussion with an atheist. This time he's sitting down with a Christian to talk about whether his approach to science in his book, having gone from faith to atheism back to faith again, he's going to be talking about his particular way of approaching science and faith in conjunction with a Christian mathematician and thinker, J.D. Walters. So that should be a really interesting conversation to tune in for or download at the same time next week. Time to get into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
On Unbelievable today, we're maxing out the whole show with our discussion, and we're asking what's the best explanation of the universe, God or naturalism. Luke Barnes, astrophysicist and Christian, joins me, and he's sort of asking the questions about whether there's something beyond the universe. The fact that we live in a very finely tuned universe is one interesting aspect that he's written about in a book with atheist physicist Geraint Lewis, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos. We're going to get into discussing those aspects of whether there's a divine or natural explanation for that, what would be the best explanation. Sean Carroll, well-known cosmologist, a research professor of physics at Caltech in the USA, also on the line. His most recent book, The Big Picture, explains why he believes naturalism, the view that all that ultimately exists are natural forces, that best explains the nature of the universe. Again, if you want to find out more about both of them, lukebarnes.info for Luke, preposterousuniverse.com for Sean. And we've covered a lot of ground already, very ambitious, really, in terms of what we're trying to achieve in today's programme, gentlemen. But I'm really appreciating the way that the conversation is being carried out as well. Just in that last section, Luke, Sean was essentially kind of, in a sense, going on the offensive for you in terms of your view that God could be a better explanation than naturalism for the nature of the universe and so on, and saying actually the universe has a lot of aspects to it which don't fit well, as far as he can see, with a theistic view. For instance, you know, why is it so enormous? You know, it doesn't need to be nearly this big in order, if we're the kind of, you know, the end goal, if you like. It's too fine-tuned at some level. Be interested to hear what you think, you know, Sean means by that as well. And I suspect there are just some fundamental issues with generally the God hypothesis that Sean has as well, in a general way as well. But, mm-hmm. I mean, this does take us into the realm of the fine-tuning of the universe. I mean, perhaps, where do you want to begin? Do you want to begin with fine-tuning and explain your kind of perspective on that, or jump directly to some of those issues that Sean was laying out in that last section?
Let me start with fine-tuning very quickly here. Although Sean laid out the context quite well there. What would you expect if your theory was correct about the universe? And he was also very correct that that's a very hard question to answer, because we kind of know the answer to start with. But let me now, don't let me get away without trying to answer those questions that Sean raised. They're okay. Very important. But let me just as I understand it, how fine-tuning sort of hits back the other way. So we're trying to think, what sort of universe would we expect if naturalism was true? And the important thing here is there are no equations of naturalism. If I said natural stuff is the only stuff, and you said, all right, what sort of universe would you expect? The problem is that if naturalism is true, there's no answer to that. There's no deeper reason which informs that question. And so naturalism is what's called, this is a technical term in probability theory, it's called a non-informative theory. It's not supposed to be pejorative. It's just when, if my theory is that someone just guessed a 12-digit number, that doesn't tell me much about what number I'd guessed. So that's all it is. So here's how I think fine-tuning sort of addresses this question, how it's relevant. We're trying to think through, okay, if there was just a naturalistic universe, just some universe, what sort of universe would we expect? Well, here's a way we could try and answer that amongst all the possible naturalistic universes. Let's take the deepest laws of nature that we have at the moment, because they're what we have, and let's try and look for a set of possibilities that sort of naturally arise in those laws, and then look amongst that set of possibilities. So one of the things we could do, which I think is a reasonable thing to do, is say, okay, in those laws, we have what are called fundamental constants. Mm-hmm. Stuff like, how heavy is an electron? And something called the cosmological constant. There's numbers that appear that the best theories we have, they're just in the equations. We don't have any deeper understanding as to why they are what they are. Now, maybe later on we will understand that. But for the moment, they're what we've got. So trying to understand naturalism, let's just take those numbers, change them in a way that's mathematically consistent within the theory, in a way that we have to sort of understand that possibility, those possibilities to test the theory at all anyway. And let's see if there's anything interesting about our sort of neighborhood, this universe, as opposed to other possible ways the universe could have been. This, I'd suggest, is the experiment that fine-tuning kind of did sort of naturally without this end in mind. So because naturalism, there's no deeper principles than the ultimate principles of nature, what you would is, you sort of pick at random, so to speak. That's not literally true, but you would not expect one value of these parameters over any other. And so when fine-tuning finds that, this is just all in the scientific literature, that actually there would be dramatic changes in these other universes, that actually the set which allows the existence of any of the sort of complexity that would undergird any form of life we can even begin to, you know, imagine, things like, can this basic stuff of the universe stick together? Like, do the particles stick together? Will there be anything like structure in the universe? That's a very small, a ridiculously, in fact, small subset of the total. We have there a sort of test of what universe would you expect on naturalism. And overwhelmingly, because it's not informative about the ultimate laws, and because the best sort of grip we can, what we'd love to do is just test every law we can think of, and yet, you know, we can't. That's a bit. So this within this sort of test problem we have, let's change these constants. The set, you know, if you say, what would you expect? Overwhelmingly, you would expect a universe which didn't do anything remotely like the complexity we see in our universe. So that, I think, to ridiculously small numbers, the probabilities that come out are rather small. That's how I think this tries to answer that question, what would you expect on naturalism?
So, and just to reiterate, for those who maybe, and I can encourage you to go and, you know, listen to some other programs that we've done in the past on fine-tuning, but just to boil it down, it's this idea that, as you say, if you were to alter these fundamental constants and so on to the tiniest, you know, razor blade degree, you would not get a universe which could support life, because you'd find a universe which was too thinly dispersed, or where, you know, stuff couldn't bind together, or, you know, you can't get galaxies, planets, chemistry going, and that kind of thing. And so we live in a very, in a sense, unusual, as you would put it, fortunate universe. If naturalism is true, it's not the kind of universe we would expect. We would expect a universe that is sterile at some level in terms of its ability to produce life. If you know, naturalism was the fundamental kind of thing at play. Okay, so far, you know, so good in terms of describing the question that fine tuning raises in this regard. For you, Luke, God, theism, is again consistent with what we find ourselves in, the universe in which we do exist, and inconsistent with naturalism. Therefore, for you, it's on the side of a theistic explanation in that sense.
Yeah. So when Sean raises those questions, they're very good questions, and I'm certainly not saying that, you know, I could sort of go into my cave and stare into the darkness and imagine a universe and get everything right. You know, given theism, it's just that when I try and weigh up those things, this test case of fine tuning says that naturalism, the probability is so ridiculously small that actually these worries about how you would predict something given God's existence don't compare. They are worries, but I can give them a probability of one in a billion, and still it wouldn't much matter. Now, let me just clarify something quickly. It's not that I started off as an atheist, came to fine-tuning, and then, voila, I'm a Christian. I'm a Christian. I grew up that way. This is something that makes sense to me within this worldview I have, and when I try and sort of step over into the naturalist shoes and understand fine-tuning, I think it would bother me more than, you know,
okay.
Natural.
Okay, where do you want to take this from? And we will get to those questions that Sean had about, you know, if God is an explanation, why are certain aspects of our universe overly fine-tuned, or is it too large and so on? But I mean, where would you normally go with this, Sean? Do you kind of just have a fundamental problem with God as an explanation, or would you take it down the, well, there are other explanations out there, you know, and we can talk about the multiverse theory and all of that kind of thing? Where do you want to go with it?
Yeah, I feel the need to say at least three things very quickly, and then we can sort of pick and choose which one to dive into. Okay. But I'm not objecting to God as an explanation. I'm on the record as saying that the fine-tuning argument is the best evidence we have for theism. I don't think it's very good evidence, but I do think it is the best. It's a more respectable argument than the other ones that are out there. Having said that, three quick things. Number one, I don't come anywhere close to accepting that we know that the parameters are finely tuned. I certainly accept that, you know, it's plausible that that's true. I just don't have any confidence in our ability to know what the universe would be like if we changed the constants of nature, even a little bit, much less a lot. Certainly, I don't think that if we were just given the constants of nature, we could predict the kind of universe we have. So I'm not at all confident enough to say that if we change the constants of nature, we could predict the new kind of universe. So I'm not convinced that there is that kind of fine-tuning. Maybe there is. I'm not denying it. I just want to be humble about that. Number two, I don't think that it suggests the existence of God in any way. The kind of fine-tuning we're talking about is, if it does exist, the kind of fine-tuning that is necessary for the existence of complex chemical reactions. If you think that life is a complex chemical reaction, then that makes perfect sense. But most theists don't think that. They think that life is something more than just a complex chemical reaction. So I'm not at all sure why God would fine-tune the constants of nature to allow for these complex chemical reactions that we call organic beings. And finally, I think that naturalism does provide a much better explanation for it in the form of the multiverse, like you just said. And I think that that's true not only because a multiverse can explain why we happen to find ourselves in a region of the cosmos that is hospitable to life, but the way in which our universe exists and is inhospitable to life, is hospitable to life, with all these other galaxies, with all these other parameters, like the mass of the bottom quark that have nothing to do with life, that's the kind of universe you would expect in a naturalistic multiverse explanation for the fine-tuning that allows complex structures.
Well, there's plenty for us to get going with right there. So why don't we see what Luke has to say in response to those three areas that you outlined very helpfully there. Firstly, not at all convinced there is a fine-tuning thing here. We just don't know what those universes would actually look like if we tinkered with the fundamental constants and so on. Luke, I mean, do you simply disagree that we can be pretty sure that we wouldn't get anything like what we know as a life-permitting universe?
So I think we can be pretty sure. I don't think there can be an in principle problem here, because the questions we're asking are just questions of theoretical physics in a more complicated scenario, because we're talking about life. But if the laws of nature were such and such, the outcome would be so and so, is exactly what theoretical physics is about. So if the cosmological constant were very large, then the universe would be mostly a sort of thin hydrogen suit with no galaxies, is the sort of statement that theoretical physics should be able to make. Now, so the doubt can't be an in-principle doubt, but an in-practice doubt. Now, I'm perfectly happy with humility about these sorts of things, but some of these cases are so clear that I don't think that's much of a problem.
And if, as far as I can tell, your author, your co-author, Geraint, fundamentally agrees with you, at least on at that level, that there is a phenomenon of fine-tuning, whether or not it is a designed fine-tuning in that sense.
Yeah, I think he'd happily say something like, you know, if the cosmological constant had been anywhere close to what you might call its natural value, something up at the Planck range, then we wouldn't be here talking right now. Mm. There'd be no such thing as words or books or people or conversation.
Sure. But none of it, even if I grant you the fine-tuning, says Sean, suggests God. Okay, where do you want to go with what he had to say about that?
So the question of why would God fine-tune the universe, you know, I think most theists would think that at least that our life, whatever it is supported in some sense by complex chemical reactions. So it's what I need is all the fine-tuning needs is sort of the inverse of that. If there were not these complex chemical reactions, then there wouldn't be natural life as the sort that we understand. Now, what you could say, what some people have said, well, even in a universe which wasn't fine-tuned, God could still make it the case that matter does the things necessary for life. So God, even in a universe where chemistry wasn't possible, God could make it possible by doing those sorts of things.
God could simply bypass fine-tuning, in a sense.
Right. The problem is, I don't think Sean can say that, and I'd love to get his view on this, because Sean, as we said before, is a Humean. So what that means is that there's not two things. There's not the way that the laws of nature are, and on the other hand, the way the universe actually behaves. Those are the same thing. So you cannot say that the universe, the laws of nature are such that the universe wouldn't support life, but the universe actually behaves in a way to support life. Though that's something that Sean can't say, if I understand his view correctly. I'm sure he'll deal with it in a second. But more generally, I think at least we can understand why God might want to create a universe in which the way that people interact with each other is via an external environment, which is predictable in some sense, right? That's what gives us the ability to influence each other's lives in a morally relevant way. We're not just, you know, floating completely oblivious to each other. We're not playing with Monopoly money. We really can influence each other.
Let's leave the question of whether a multiverse explanation, you know, on naturalism kind of does also answer the question anyway, to last, if you like, and just go ahead with these two elements that you've thrown up as a question. So, yeah, I mean, firstly, Luke's just throwing it back to you, I guess, there, Sean, and saying, look, there are clearly some elements of the fine-tuning that it's clear that we would not, simply could not get a universe in which anything interesting would happen if you changed the values and so on. So it is a phenomenon that you have to kind of own up to, I guess, is Luke's point.
Yeah, again, I do not have any principled scientific argument that says that our universe is not finely tuned. I'm just very, very skeptical about attempts to quantify it and say what would happen if the parameters were different. I agree that, for example, if the cosmological constant were at the Planck scale, for those of you listening at home, this is to say if the energy of empty space were enormously, enormously larger than we observe it to be today, then it's very hard to imagine a universe that just has enough room for interesting things to happen. But this is sort of exactly the kind of case where it almost becomes a God of the gaps kind of issue, because there are famous examples of fine-tuning. Why is the cosmological constant small? Why is the average energy density of the universe exactly the critical density? Which, when they appear to us to be very finely tuned, but what that means is we have a guess for what they might have been, and what we observe them to be is something very, very specific. But you know what? Maybe the guess was just wrong. In the case of the density of the universe, we actually have quantitative explanations for why it is exactly the value it has. So what used to be a fine tuning just becomes the most natural thing in the world. The cosmological constant, the energy density of the vacuum, I suspect is going to be exactly the same thing. There are theories on the market, and I'm in favor of some of them myself, that say, in fact, we just had the wrong guess. You know, if we understand quantum gravity well, the fact that there's this huge hierarchy between the cosmological constant and the quantum gravity scale is the most natural thing in the world.
So I guess it's to say there's going to be probably underlying principles that we'll get to, Luke, which will kind of perfectly naturally explain the reason that these numbers take the particular value they do in that sense. I mean, does that, in a sense, solve, you know, dismiss fine-tuning, or is it just kicking it up another level or whatever it might be?
So the worry I have is this. So we have, as Sean said, there's ideas on the market, but there's a lot of them. So the way I present it was, let's try and do the best we can with what we've got. So if one of those theories comes along and says, all right, here is my deeper explanation for what's going on, then we'll ask the fine-tuning question of that theory as well. We will ask it, for example, Sean was referring to cosmic inflation possibly your other work on the density of the universe, the flatness problem as well. When those ideas come along, we'll have a look at them. The point of my argument is just saying let's do the best we can with the ideas that we've got. But even beyond then, think about the ultimate laws of nature up on that blackboard again, like Alberta's blackboard, that we've had the universe solved for us. There's not going to be anything that tells us why, on naturalism, why those particular laws rather than some other laws. So we'd still ask the fine-tuning question, even if we totally solved everything in physics. If there might be the case that when we get to that final blackboard, there'll be no free numbers on that blackboard. This was Einstein's dream. That would be amazing, right? That'd be fantastic. Maybe. But what we'd still ask then, okay, what about the other ways that the ultimate principles of the universe could have been? We can ask all the same sorts of questions. Fine-tuning tries to get a handle on the best handle we can get on, if we're trying to test naturalism, what other universes could there have been? Maybe we've got the wrong set, sure. But the best we can do still suggests a problem. Then I think we've still got, naturalism still got a problem.
Well, I think it's the same kind of thing that we're talking about, why is it that way? And I'm just really happy with saying that eventually we find out that's the way it is. I'm not going to rely or lean on the idea that someday we'll find that's the only way it could have been. I'm just really happy I'm comfortable with brute facts. I don't think that there's any way around them, so I hope that everyone becomes comfortable with them. We live in a simple universe that allows for the existence of life. Is that a coincidence? If we randomly chose universes, would we have gotten something very different? Or is that something very robust? Would most universes you choose have regions in them that support life? That's where I need to be humble. I don't think that we have any right to say one way or the other. So it could be that, in fact, in the space of all possible universes, there's a sensible measure on that space, and the subset of life supporting universes is very, very small, and therefore there is a rigorous quantitative fine-tuning problem. And if that turns out to be the case in some future understanding of the possible laws of physics, then it will be good evidence for theistic fine-tuning. But I just don't think that we're anywhere close to that.
Quick response, and then we must move on to multiverse before we close out today's program, Luke.
Well, it seems like we could do all of that you just said, and that Sean just said, and still say, there's this small number, and so we say the universe is life-permitting, and that's all there is to it. There are brute facts. Why not fine-tune brute facts? And that's the end of the story. So I think what's quite clear, and why I quite like Sean's book on this, is that's kind of the price of naturalism. Whatever turns up on Alberta's blackboard, the ultimate laws of physics, you just have to grin and smile and say those are the ultimate brute facts of reality. And if they look fine-tuned, or if there's a beginning of the cosmos, or if they're if they're ridiculously elegant or simpler than you might expect, or whatever the case may be, you just say that's the ultimate principles. We've explained reality, and you high five and go to the pub.
Well, I'm looking forward to the pub after this, but we. Why don't we just talk? Because we could go on talking about this for the rest of the remaining time. But I do want us to get to the issue of the multiverse, because obviously you tackle this in the book. And in a sense, this is a kind of where you and Geraint part ways in your own book here, Luke. Because obviously Geraint believes that a naturalistic explanation is at hand in the multiverse explanation. And if I can very briefly surmise that as a layman, it's the idea that we are but one of many universes that could have been produced, say, in an inflationary period of the universe. And that if all of, if they each come out with all kinds of different values and fundamental constants and so on, then we just happen to live in one of the ones that is able to produce a life and so on. And so we won the lottery, effectively, is the kind of view of that. That's a very, very small sketch of what we're talking about here. So for you, Sean, this, if you like, is the other card that you can play to Luke to say, yes, I'm very happy that we do have a naturalistic explanation here. How convinced are you personally, Sean, of a multiverse, given that it's obviously something, as far as I'm aware, we can't physically access, we can't sort of directly scientifically investigate in that sense?
Yeah, I would say I'm not at all confident about the multiverse in any sense whatsoever. I mean, to be very honest, I think that Maybe we live in a multiverse. Maybe we don't. 50-50 chance. I'm not going to bet any money on it either way. I can see, given our current quite crude understanding of quantum gravity and early universe cosmology, plausible scenarios either way. And I think that if we really, really do convince ourselves that there it requires a substantial amount of fine-tuning of the physical parameters to allow for complex life, for me as a naturalist, that would qualify as good evidence in favor of living in a multiverse.
Okay. But for you, even though you're not particularly confident in the concept of a multiverse, it's still a better explanation on the table than a God explanation.
Yeah, absolutely. Because once again, I balance in my mind what would the universe look like in one scenario versus what it would look like in another one. I mean, we haven't even talked about all the reasons why I think that the theistic predictions are wildly different than the universe that we see, not just in cosmological terms, but down here in human life terms. So to me, the evidence against the existence of anything like the classical theistic God is overwhelmingly strong. And therefore, the fact that there's a perfectly good explanation for biophilic fine-tuning right there on the floor in the terms of the multiverse is perfectly comfortable to me.
Okay. So, Luke, obviously there's a wider data set that Sean is using here because there are other reasons for him thinking that God is not a good explanation anyway. And so, yeah, as it stands, on the basis of that fact, even though he's not completely confident in a multiverse, it's still a better explanation. It's still a more likely scenario as to why we live in an apparently finely tuned universe. So where do you go on this one?
So don't get me wrong. I am a cosmologist. So a multiverse, you know, that's just more universe for me, right? So that's I don't have any problem with that. Specifically, you know, as a theist, there could still be a multiverse. That might be the most natural way, simple way to make a universe in which some part of it is life permitting. So I don't particularly have a problem here. Thinking in fine-tuning terms, though, here's the problem. So let me just do a test case here. Suppose the fundamental parameter of our universe we were thinking about, fundamental in inverted commas, was the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Let's go back to, you know, Ptolemy or whatever. And someone works out, oh, hang on, if the Earth were this much closer to the Sun, we'd all boil, and if we were further away, we'd all freeze. So that looks fine-tuned. And then someone says, oh, no, hang on a sec, there's heaps of other planets out there. The universe will just make a whole heap of planets. They'll be at all sorts of distances from their suns. And so that will explain why there's some planet somewhere which gets it right for life. Okay, what I now want to do is to say, okay, we're trying to think of, in naturalism, a set of naturalistic universes. We now got to ask the question, what does it take for a universe in terms of deeper, more actually fundamental quantities, like how heavy is an electron? What does it take for a universe to make lots of planets? That's the question I want to ask about this theory. And we find, if fine-tuning is correct, which I argue it is, that actually that requires a lot from fundamental physics. And so now that we do it again, we say now there's lots of places in the universe where there's different values of these numbers. And what I want to do is to say, okay, great, show me a theory. What are its fundamental assumptions? And will it do all of that in a natural way, or will it do that in a fine-tuned way? And because we don't have any sort of anything like a final theory of the universe, we can't do that calculation. And so really, the problem is, I think we have a good handle in fine-tuning of a way to actually get at, you know, what would I expect on naturalism? And the response is to try and punt that sort of into the darkness, so where I can't do the calculation, the idea that I actually want to do. So that's one of my problems with this. Even if there is a multiverse, it's not, it doesn't necessarily explain fine-tuning.
Sean?
Yeah, I think I got lost somewhere there. I hate to say, because Luke is extraordinarily clear, this is probably my fault, but the general idea of the multiverse, which, by the way, you know, again, we don't know if it's true, and even the phrase the multiverse, like all of these different ideas we're talking about, has many, many different versions of it, right? Mm-hmm. So you could have a multiverse where nowhere in the multiverse was it possible to have life, or a multiverse where everywhere is just like our universe out there. But the idea that gets people excited comes from what is called the landscape of string theory, where in string theory, also in other theories, but string theory is the most popular one, what you find is that space-time itself is kind of like water in the sense that it appears in different phases. Water has a liquid phase, a solid phase, a gas phase, and so forth. So space, with all of its particles and forces in it, also has all of these different phases. And when you go through the math, we have no idea how many phases there are, but it's gi-humongous numbers, right? Something like 10 to the 500 is the famous number to bat about. And if that's true, then we also have separately this theory of eternal inflation, this idea that the universe can undergo a super rapid expansion at early times, and then quantum fluctuations can kick you from one phase of space-time to another one. So not only is it possible to have local regions of space where the laws of physics are very different, but it's natural. It's a prediction. You know, the multiverse on the side of physicists and cosmologists was not something that came about either because we were just saying, you know, well, wouldn't it be cool? There were all these universes, or something that came about because people said, well, we have fine-tuning. How do we explain that? It came about, you know, we were dragged into it, kicking and screaming, because we had other reasons to like these theories called inflation and string theory, and together they predict a multiverse, like it or not. And within that understanding, we should get so many different kinds of conditions of what's going on in space-time that it is essentially inevitable that some of them will be perfectly hospitable to the existence of life.
I mean, let's have one response from you, Luke, to that, but which is essentially, you know, Sean laying out again the way in which the multiverse is a conceivable possibility. And I mean, from your perspective, though, I think what you've been saying is, even if I grant you such a multiverse, it doesn't get you off the hook in terms of having to justify the fine tuning of kind of a multiverse itself and those kinds of things. But unfortunately, because it's out of reach, scientifically speaking, if you like, you're kind of positing something that kind of gets you off the hook of having to answer that particular question. Is that?
Yeah, let me just say there is debate amongst cosmologists, and Sean's more in this world than I am, about whether, in fact, eternal inflation is inevitable as Sean just claimed it was. And that's you know, the sort of calculation I would like to do, which we can do for fine-tuning, which I would like to do for inflation, it's a bit up in the air as to whether that's true or not. But that's too much more would go too far afield. I want to get back to Sean's questions.
Mm. What are the questions, then, that you specifically want to respond as we close things out here?
Well, Sean's challenges for naturalism... for theism, and particularly, is this the kind of universe that we would expect on theism? Are very good, well laid out in the book, by the way, his book. There's an interesting little assumption in there, and so Sean said that if we thought that we were important to God, we should play a crucial role in this universe, and that I don't see the connection between those two. Right, my kids do nothing for the structural integrity of my house. Right? Nothing whatsoever. I don't see why, if we were important to God, we would have we would expect a human-sized universe, because we don't measure importance with physical size. And in particular, I think one of the effects that the universe has had on the history of humanity is that as we've looked at the infinitely huge universe, we've realized our smallness, and that has been, for thousands of years, the best handle that human beings can get on the sort of infinity of God. And so I'm not saying it's a prediction, I'm not saying it's something ahead of time I could have discovered in the cave, but certainly the worry I have about that consideration, would I expect a universe this big on theism, the sort of handle that gives me on this question is pales in comparison to the problem I think fine-tuning raises for naturalism.
We're going to go to some final comments here, because I've taken up already too much of your time, gentlemen, and this is a sort of extended, really, edition of the podcast, exclusively for podcast listeners, really. We won't be able to fit all of this conversation into the radio edition of the programme. But where do you want to start to draw things together, Sean? It's been a really interesting conversation. Where do you want to land up?
Yeah, I mean, I think I feel the need to say one more thing just at that last point, which maybe works as a beginning of a summing up,
okay,
which is that,
go ahead.
Ironically enough, I feel that theists don't give God nearly as much credit as he deserves. I think that if God existed, you know, God could do whatever God wants. That's kind of God's thing, right? And the remarkable feature of the world that we observe is that it looks really, really, really close to as if God isn't doing anything. Right? Things are obeying the laws of physics. Things are obeying their natural things. There's not a lot of obvious interventions. God could have just created the solar system or the galaxy rather than this giant universe. And the usual move is to say, well, God likes to see nature obeying the laws of physics, right? God likes to work in ways that are the least interventionist when it comes to physics and cosmology. And that's completely plausible. I mean, that's possible. I don't see any derivation of that idea from the notion of God all by itself. To me, it sounds like special pleading. To me, it sounds exactly like the situation where you say, I know what the universe looks like already. Let me think about what God would have done. Oh, yes, exactly this kind of thing. The alternative is to say that, you know, God is not actually playing an important role in the whole shebang.
Is it special pleading, Luke, as far as you're concerned?
Oh, your listeners are going to have to work that out for themselves. I certainly understand that point of view. I think all I'd say is that, you know, you have to take both sides of this very seriously. One of the things that I think is a very important thing for theists to think through is the famous problem of evil. So we look at the things in our universe which don't seem to fit, and you know, like, you know, pain and suffering and all those sorts of things. And those are things that people say, you know, why would a good God do that sort of thing? No one's ever attempted an argument from love or an argument from beauty or against God. Mm. These are things that intuitively make sense to me. If there's a God, a universe would be beautiful. Yeah, that sort of makes sense. Again, not a prediction. It's something we understand. So I think the fact that people see how that bit fits, at least, that no one's tried to produce the sort of atheistic argument from beauty, is possibly a way of putting that, but people are going to have to decide this one for themselves, I think.
We're going to have to start to leave it there, I'm afraid, gentlemen. It's been really, really fascinating getting you both on the programme today. We could have gone on for another hour at least talking about some of these issues, but I really appreciate the way you both handled yourself and the tremendous food for thought we've had in the course of today's programme. If you want to get in touch, I'll be giving out the ways to do that in just a moment's time, but for the moment, do get hold of both Sean and Luke's books, and you'll be able to look into these things at a deeper level as well for yourself. Again, preposterousuniverse.com for Sean, and Luke is at lukebarnes.info, and more about his book A Fortunate Universe there. Sean, thank you very much for being on the programme with me today.
Sure, my pleasure. It was a lot of fun.
It was great fun to have you on. Luke, thank you for popping in as part of your tour while you're over here in the UK.
Thanks very much. And Sean's point about overtuning is on page 311 of his book, if you want to get... Sorry about that.
Great.
You can buy that right now, and you can buy Luke's book, I'm sure, on Amazon from your iPhone right now.
Great stuff. Thank you both, gentlemen, and all the very best. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. You're
unbelievable. Well, it's been a lot of fun recording today's programme, and if you want to get in touch about anything you've heard, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And don't forget, you can find out more about today's show, links to my guests, and of course, more details about other aspects of Unbelievable at the show page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So we have maxed out today's show with discussion, so no time for feedback. We'll try and do as much of that as we can on next week's programme, though. Thank you for joining me on today's programme. And come again next week, if you can. Mike McCarg. Well, he's well known for his own podcast, Ask Science Mike, as well as a co-host of the Liturgist podcast. And he had a new book out last year, Finding God in the Waves. He was able to join me here in my studio to have a conversation with J.D. Walters on his own approach to science and faith. So if you enjoyed today's show, I think you'll enjoy that one too. Come back for that same time next week here on Unbelievable. And if you stay tuned here on Premier Christian Radio, coming up next, I'll be speaking to leading progressive Christian voice in the USA, Brian McLaren. For the moment, thanks for being with me on today's show. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.